Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second day of the 5th Annual Bay Area Book Festival. I'm Sherilyn Parsons. I'm the founder and director, and it's really my privilege. I mean, what an incredibly illustrious panel we have with us today for a session titled Courage in Publishing in the Age of Political Polarization. And we are being recorded by C-SPAN, so many other people will also be able to see this event. I'm going to, I think what we're going to do is I will introduce each speaker and ask a, let me change the plan here. I'm going to briefly introduce each speaker and then ask a question and have them jump in as they see fit with a response to that question. And then I think we're kind of going to be off and running at that point. So directly to my right is John Freeman, and he is the editor of Freeman's Journal, a biannual journal featuring leading writers from around the world and also emerging talent. He was the editor of Granta for many years, and he is the author of several books, including Maps, a poetry volume, and Tale of Two Americas. Do I have it right? All right. Okay. So thank you, John Freeman, for coming. We have Michael Nauman directly to his right. He has worked for decades at the nexus of the literary, cultural, and political worlds. Between 1985 and 95, he was publisher and CEO of the German publishing company Rowohlt. Am I pronouncing that more or less? Okay. He then jumped the Atlantic and for a few years headed the New York-based publisher Henry Holt, where he was involved in the U.S. edition of the Satanic Verses. So we've got certainly a story of courage in publishing there. And in 1998, he was appointed commissioner for cultural affairs in Germany. Then he led the German weekly Die Zeit, chief editor, then publisher. And since 2012, he served as the director of the Barenboim Said Academy. And he writes a lot about cultural affairs and politics, particularly in Europe. So to his right, we have Emily Nemens, and she joined the Paris Review as editor in 2018. She published, before that, she was at the Southern Review, where she published many stories that were selected for the Pushcart Prize, Best American Short Stories, O. Henry Prize, Pen America Debut Fiction, and her own debut novel, The Cactus League, is forthcoming from Ferrestrasse Giroux. And to her right, we've got a lot of people here. Kwame Anthony Appiah is the author of numerous books, including most recently As If, Idealization and Ideals, and The Lies That Bind, and I actually brought a copy of that here, Rethinking Identity and Cosmopolitanism. He's been president of the Pen America Center, and in 2018 he chaired the Man Booker Prize jury. So he was raised in Ghana and educated in England, and he's taught philosophy on three continents. When we were connecting, he was in Dubai, so he goes all over the place. He currently writes the Ethicist column at the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and he's a professor of philosophy and law at New York University. On his right, we have Jane Chavatari, who is VP Online and former president of the National Books Critics Circle, and she is a columnist for BBC.com and LitHub, and she contributes regularly to NPR and others. She's also the author of two story collections, and I think she reads more than anyone I know and faster, and it's just a literary encyclopedia. And to her right, on the far end, we have Carlos Lozada, who you may know won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism, and he was just saying that it's been about 20 years since Books has won the Pulitzer for Criticism. So we're happy to bring Books into the conversation. And so nonfiction book critic for the Washington Post. He's also served as the Post's economic editor, national security editor, and Outlook editor. And in addition to winning this year's Pulitzer, he was a finalist for criticism last year, and he's won the 2015 National Books Critics Circle Citation for Excellence in Reviewing. So that is a lot of tremendous experience in the publishing world. And I wanted to start with a very general question so that these panelists really can sort of set the tone for the conversation. So whoever wants to jump in, about your take on the state of the industry today in this age of political polarization. So it's very broad. Who would like to jump in? Go for it. Go for it. I was going to ask that question of every person, but I thought, you know, that's a little long. So let's.
Carolyn, I have a thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
What if we look at recent awards?
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes that tells us what we're reading and what we're valuing and what the gatekeepers are choosing. And I remember Anthony was the head judge for this year's Booker Award. And those choices, as I recall, you said had a really a new take on what literature is. And the winner was Anna Burns as Milkman, which went on to win the National Book Critics Circle Award in Fiction this year. And our Poetry Award winner was Ada Limón. And our Sandroff Award winner, which Ben was at one point, which is for Lifetime Achievement, was Arte Publico Press, which is 40 years old, based down in Texas, and they were being honored for publishing Latinx literature for the last 40 years in bilingual editions and translating into English. So that's a thought on some awards, but maybe some of the rest of you might want to add to, like Pulitzers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man Booker.
Go ahead, Anthony. Sounds like you have something to say. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what was interesting about the experience of being the chair of the Booker Committee, that you can read 171 novels in a year, while holding down a job, but B, that I felt very cheerful at the end of it because there were so many wonderful novels. Now, I know it's of course a completely biased sample. It's the novels that the publishers think are the best things they've published, so they jolly well ought to be good. But still, another good thing about them, I think, was the range of what was nominated.
Yeah.
We on our long list, we had a graphic novel for the first time. I think that's kind of overdue, but probably publishers weren't nominating graphic novels because they thought that the kind of people who sit on the Booker Committee would look down their nose at them.
Hmm.
I thought Sabrina was just a brilliant book. I would say the one thing there wasn't was any utopian fiction, but I think that's a perfectly reasonable reflection of our moment.
Right, we're dystopian these days.
We're dystopian. So all the future-oriented novels, whether they were science fiction or other kinds of fiction, tended to be quite downbeat, mm-hmm. but as I say, I mm-hmm. think, you know, that's natural. Just on the question of sort of, you know, who daring to publish, I'm sure there are things that the very fine publishers who nominate for the Booker would be scared to publish.
Hmm.
Partly for reasons to do with the sort of thing that happened to Salman's book. Partly for a different kind of reason, which is that people are very anxious now not to be associated with work that is sexist or tolerant of certain kinds of misbehavior. I noticed a couple of days ago before I came out here that Woody Allen's book is having a hard time finding a publisher.
Hmm.
I suspect that's why.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that most people would ordinarily have thought that if you published a book by Woody Allen, you could sell it.
Mm-hmm.
So there must be some... And that is connected with the thing that presumably is going to be a source of anxiety increasingly, which is that, there are Twitter storms arise and you can get into terrible trouble. And the thought that your other books might be damaged,
mm-hmm.
their prospects, by people who gang up and boycott publishers who publish books that they don't approve of. I think that's not an unreasonable fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's cancel culture, happening. There was recently an article in the New York Times, and it was a book, a YA young adult book by Emily Wen Zhao titled Blood Air. And that book was, the author chose to cancel that book to terminate the publication of that book a few months before it was scheduled to be published based on some reaction of early readers to the book. They felt it was racist. They felt it was there were some inappropriate depictions of slavery. And the author pulled the book, and the publisher was kind of willing to go either way, depending on the author's wishes. And she has recently changed her mind, and she's gone ahead and published the book. She did quite a bit of research on it, into the book, and she ran it by what's now called sensitivity readers, who are readers with deep familiarity, often their own lived experience of the background of what's being depicted. And so she did some work on the book, but has decided to publish it, and it created this firestorm of response on the internet. People on both sides, largely the response was that she should be able to write whatever she wants to write. Of course, there are issues right now of, you know, there's a term, respectability politics. I mean, what right do you have to write things, not only outside your experience, but that may be perceived as inappropriately presenting certain aspects of society, certain characters. And does anyone want to jump in on that? What do you think? Carlos, it looks like you have some responses.
No, I inhabit a completely different world of reading and of writing. I focus solely on nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Given my gig at the Washington Post, a lot of it is political nonfiction. So I come to this kind of conversation with all the insights and mainly the blind spots that kind of focus gives me. I think there comes a moment when no one is safe, really. There was a remarkable instance recently, I'm forgetting his name right now, of a novel by someone whose side gig is as a sensitivity reader, which itself was... Yes,
Yosiko Jackson, exactly. Who was supposed to appear at this festival, by the way, and then the book was canceled.
And he himself fell victim to the same sort of cancel culture. What I'll say from the nonfiction side of things a little bit is that I see a lot of the publishing industry both following and reflecting the trends in political polarization. Mm-hmm. On what can be broadly considered the sort of resistance literature, for instance, in this moment, there's some wonderful work. I've been really impressed with what Timothy Snyder has done with his books, not just on tyranny, but The Road to Unfreedom. But more often than not, you get these essay anthologies by a series of like-minded, obsessively like-minded writers who end up, screaming, this is not who we are, over and over again. And I understand the impulse, but I question the usefulness of that kind of that kind of publishing. On the right, it's a little more complicated. But basically, you see these two large trends where you have writers who have either made their peace with the new political realities or seek to take advantage of it. Because they feel they can get their sort of more traditionalist or retrograde policies put forward, and therefore write these very accommodationist, pandering books to our new moment, and you have the conservatives who are horrified by the Trump era and write book length breakup letters to the conservative movement, and to the Republican Party, yet without really grappling with their own complicity and their own role and how this all came to pass. And then my people, the journalists, we sort of do these deeply reported, in-depth stories about the mayhem inside the White House that all sound the same. Mm-hmm. Is this a lack of courage? Is it pursuing the market? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you would call that. But it's... again, I've been in this job for about 4 years now, and I have had a chance to read a lot of wonderful work coming out of this moment of polarization, but a lot of it seems really focused to one particular audience, sort of playing to a kind of home crowd that is pre-baked in.
And that crowd is?
That crowd is, whichever side you wanna.
Okay. There's a bunch of different crowds.
Yeah, it's a bunch of different crowds, and they're not really talking to one another very much. Not to not to do my own pandering here, but I think Anthony's book on identity is one that doesn't easily fit into these different lanes. There's plenty to piss off everybody. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. But you know, and so that, yeah, that makes,
I like
me
that
makes me wonder.
That's
a good thing.
There's a blurb. There's a blurb.
Right. There you go. Right.
That makes me wonder. Yeah, that's a better word.
Spacious.
Capacious mind.
Yeah,
right.
Capacious.
But you know, then books that try to do that often have a hard time finding that. You know, what is your pre-cooked audience? You know, who are the people who are going to be your champions? So anyway, that's simply from the vantage point of someone who spends too much time in nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. But wait a minute, Carlos Lozada, you just reviewed the Mueller report, which I think required a little bit of publishing courage, and you treated it as a narrative. Can you tell us about that review?
It's the best review ever.
Has anybody seen that review?
So I work at the Washington Post, and everyone at the Washington Post, I think all, like, you know, 800 journalists, whatever, were writing about the Mueller report when it came out. And so I read it overnight. It was posted online at 11 a.m., and so I printed 448 pages and read, and then went home and kept reading and finished it overnight, and then wrote a piece the next morning. And since all my colleagues were already dissecting every little bit of news in it, I thought all I could do was treat it as a book. I would say it's probably the best of these, you know, inside of the White House books that try to tell you what's going on, only because Robert Mueller, you know, can put people under oath, which most nonfiction writers, you know, can't do. Imagine that Bob Woodward had subpoena power, you know? Like, that would be kind of cool. But but again, I think that it doesn't. It's this moment in politics can always shock, but it no longer surprises, right? If you see what I mean by that difference, and all the things that we learned in the Mueller report are consistent with the kind of writing that has come out of these, you know, inside the White House books, even the ones that you may think are not, you know, from Fire and Fury to Fear, you know. And so the Mueller Report is now the number one New York Times nonfiction bestseller. I mean, it may be one of those books that everyone buys but no one reads. It's the new Infinite Jest.
Certainly, but, the Attorney General doesn't appear to have read it, so.
Yes.
Yeah. Anthony, you want to comment on what he's been saying? Yeah.
He said that very softly.
Yeah. What did you say?
I just said the Attorney General doesn't seem to have read it, but
right. He shouldn't have reviewed it.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, so just in terms of the background here, I wrote a piece actually in the Washington Post last summer about the character of our divisions, because I think one way to put it is that if you do sort of polling, you discover that attitudes to intergroup marriage between conservatives and liberals, or between Democrats and Republicans, are about where they were to interracial marriage in the 1950s. If you ask people the question, would you want your daughter, son, say, to marry someone from whatever the other party is, if you've identified with one of these parties, and of course there's a large number of people who haven't identified with either, but if you've identified with one of them, there's a 30 to 60% chance that you'll say you don't want your kids to marry one of the other thing. Mm-hmm. Now, we cannot run a sensible republic if that's how we feel about each other. We're supposed to be running it together. And that means we have to be able to make compromises with one another. And if our view of the other is just that they're crazy, that it's not worth trying to understand what's driving them, that they don't make sense, that perhaps they're evil, how are we going to do that? We can't. So then you look at the data about what people actually believe, and it turns out that within these vast tribes, there's actually quite a diversity of opinion. People who call themselves conservative, there are plenty of people who are conservative who think Roe v. Wade's just fine. I mean, they won't say so because they know they're not supposed to, but that's mm-hmm. a different question. Mm-hmm. And similarly, there are quite a lot of people who identify as Democrats or liberals who are troubled by the scale of abortion in our country and would like to see some attempt to rein it in. So now, that's a hard one because it's not easy to see what a compromise looks like on a topic like that. But on lots of other topics, like healthcare and reducing the size of the prison population and so on, there's actually a huge consensus. But because we're in these tribes, when one of the tribes proposes a sensible option, it automatically becomes impossible for the other tribe to endorse it. Remember that this basic structure of Obamacare was invented at the Heritage Foundation. But because, which, by the way, if you don't know, is a right-wing organization. So if the mere fact that it was taken up by a Democratic president made it then something that conservatives would oppose. Now, probably there's been a switch on Russia. Probably 5 years ago, the typical left person thought we were too anti-Russian, and the typical right person thought we were too, we should go after them in the way that John McCain thought. Seems to have been a shift. I guess what happened was that Donald Trump seemed to be a Russophile, which forced the conservatives to think, okay, Russia must be all right. And the fact that Donald Trump thinks Russia's all right forced the left to think, oh, they must be worse than we thought. Nobody, there's no new information here, except that they tried to screw our last election, which should have outraged everybody, right? That shouldn't have been a partisan thing. We shouldn't have people using their power to interfere with the most important of our democratic processes. But my point is only that everybody does this. Everybody shifts around in this tribal way. Once something's a shibboleth of one tribe, the other, it's one of the idols to burn down for the other. Yeah. So I think, so in that context, you do run the risk that, you know, you get identified as a house, a publishing house, with one of these things. The other people won't listen. And that's a problem, because it would be nice if we had a world in which there were things that we all paid attention
to. And books are supposed to do that. I mean, you know, the Twitter sphere and so on, it tends to be one-sided. You know, we've talked at this festival about, you know, Facebook isolating, you know, further reinforcing one's beliefs. But what books can do is really develop a longer-form argument in terms of nonfiction. And for fiction is to show the other and experience the other. And yet, do you feel that books are, I don't want to say failing at that, but they're increasingly speaking to their own tribe. And Michael's been wanting to say something, I can tell. So please jump in.
Yeah, well, here. I was in publishing, a publisher for 14 years of my life, and I founded Metropolitan Books in New York, definitely a leftist-leaning, probably the only new foundation of a leftist-leaning serious book company in the United States at that time. Things have changed, obviously. Later, I also became CEO of Henry Holt, and so suddenly I had both sides. A liberal publishing house run by Sarah Bershtell, some of you may know her, and of course a middle-of-the-road publishing house, which then suddenly hit, after lots of Sue Grafton bestsellers, suddenly had Fire and Fury on its list. So we've moved, so to speak, into the middle, Henry Holt did. But before that, I ran Rowvold. And in 12 years, I had 7 Nobel Prize winners, which really saved the company. Unlike here, Hertha Müller sells here about maybe 2,000 or 3,000 books, in Germany, 100,000. So you also have transoceanic tribes of readers. Obviously, has a lot to do with the historical background of these two continents and what we do remember in our history and totalitarian realities, which are a bit closer to us than they are here, and unless you look a bit into Central America. But in the, what I'm trying to say is that books, unlike what you might have suggested, really do not really serve the purpose of changing readers' political minds. They do really actually affirm what is already there. I'd like to see one book in the history of publishing that really changed its readers' mind. Karl Marx, The Kapital, I think sold altogether about 3,000 copies. Unfortunately, one ended up in Lenin's hand. but the reality is, it is usually other circumstances. That's probably true for the Quran too, and even the Bible. So there's huge amount of other social effects that changed people's mind and helped to coalesce an audience for one kind of a group of books. I personally would hate to subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, although there is no reason not to. But life is short, and you know, you want to live with one set of opinions to reaffirm your life as you have coffee in the morning. So as publishers, I would always say, let's not fool ourselves. Not a single great piece of fiction will change more than maybe 300 or 400 books readers in an audience of 100,000. That's my pessimistic opinion. So how does it happen slowly that there develops a sense of quality? And who affirms the quality? Despite my good luck with the Nobel Prize Committee, it isn't the Nobel Prize Committee in Stockholm which qualifies a Nobel Prize winner. Look at the fact that this, I can say that, and anybody who's here from the press can quote me, this idiot called Engdahl, who's the chief of the committee of the Nobel Prize committee, firmly affirmed many years ago that he'll never will give a Nobel Prize to an American author. I'm not making this up, and I talked to this about Roth to Ross, and he said he didn't say that, and of course he did. He meant it. So, in other words, there are tastes, literary tastes that span and divide the ocean, and how this happens is a mystery, basically. I'll stop, but I'd like to point out that Faulkner sold more copies in the 30s in Germany than in the United States. And Hemingway was a huge bestseller, and a whole group, unfortunately, of German writers grew up in the belief that they write like Hemingway. In fact, they wrote like his miserable translator. I'd like to point out, since you're all knowledgeable, translators in Germany are protected under copyrights too. And she got a percentage on his German fees, and she never quit her rights to the translations until she died. So we finally started to retranslate Hemingway now in the right way. And so there's an enormous amount of facts which make publishing an adventure, because you never really know what's going to be a hit.
But why would people be so concerned about the books that are published if they do not have an effect on readers? You know, I mean, banned books, right? Why do they ban a book if they don't believe that it will change a mind and a heart in ways that the people banning don't want to have happen?
Well, can I say something to this? I published Rushdie, me and a couple of others, I was also, as a journalist, covered the Iranian Revolution, so I was in the good position to really promise you that Khomeini never read the book. He never did.
Well,
some idiot from his circles read the book, and probably some review, a Western, non-Islamic reviewer, pointed out that the Muhammad is being challenged in the book in the form of a satire. And they decided to go ahead. I mean, in Germany, thousands of Jewish publishers, Jewish books, authors rather, literally thousands, were banned by, of course, a movement which was proud and being stupid and having read very few books. So with the exception, unfortunately, of Hitler, he read a lot, but didn't understand a lot. But what I'm trying to say is, to answer your questions, just as it is almost impossible to understand how books change minds of masses, individual minds all the time. My life was changed by a couple of books. And to come back to what's going on now in America as to publishing, I promise you, there's this new prudishness in this country. Do you think Henry Miller would find a publisher in America today? Or would there be a hashtag, Henry? You know? I doubt it. And so how does this happen? How do moral attitudes change, improve from an enlightened point of view, or deteriorate remains a mystery and puts a lot of sociologists into business.
Thank you. I'd like Emily or John to jump into the conversation. Any thoughts, Emily?
Yeah, I think I've been acquiring for a year now at the magazine, four issues, so it's a bit anecdotal what I've experienced. But, you know, with every story and with every issue, as I'm assembling them, I am thinking ahistorically or very historically back to 53 and a mission statement that was no axe grinders, no drum beaters. And thinking for me that means taking a step away from the political moment and really reaffirming the aesthetic and creative outlook of every piece that goes into the magazine. And that's not to say they're apolitical, but that the scales have to be tipped into a creative language and an achievement in storytelling and poetics, and assembling a magazine of that feels more necessary than ever, I'd say. Yeah. And then I think the other part of the aesthetic pursuit of the Paris Review is the first 10 minutes we're talking about political nonfiction, and I think we are all consuming that at a rapid clip and necessarily, but making room in one's life for literature feels more important than ever.
Mm-hmm. Have you had a situation where you have debated publishing something because you thought it might offend?
No.
Okay.
I'm reading, I'm thinking about so many factors, but I've not said no to something because
right. It
might be offensive.
Yeah, because you guys, it's a very bold magazine, you know, in terms of what you publish. So, John, can you jump in? Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like we're talking about several things here. As the conservative revolution crested with Trump, it's been on its way for 50 years, a pushback on the definition of civic society and the individual. There's been a simultaneous revolution in information in the last 20 to 30 years and how we get it. And the internet, let's face it, destroyed a lot of newspapers. And newspapers used to be a clearinghouse for information that you didn't ask for. It was presented to you. This is what you should care about. The Washington Post had a whole separate supplement that was 16 pages long, and the San Francisco Chronicle had one. And so the information that we were receiving about what was news and what was culture was broader, more in-depth. It had much more context, and it arrived more slowly. And now I think, well, as we've been speaking, there's a bit of blurring between civic life, intellectual life, and the commerce of publishing. And I feel often when you read articles about publishing, they're very quickly quoting people straight off of Twitter, as if Twitter and literary people who are on Twitter is publishing or is the intellectual life of a country. And Haruki Murakami is not on Twitter. Louise Erdrich is not on Twitter. Mohsen Hamid is not really on Twitter. Dave Eggers is not on Twitter. Kay Ryan, who's around the corner from here, she's not on Twitter.
Pynchon,
yeah.
William Volman, not on Twitter. Yes.
If you go through the list of the writers that you would, you know, take to a private island with you, you might find a lot of them are not on Twitter. And so why are we looking to Twitter as the definition of our culture? And if you want to look at polarization, why look at something that is run by zeros and ones to define complexity to you? It's absurd.
Yes.
And so I think our polarized political moment has a lot to do with the catastrophic and obscene amounts of wealth that are being made through policies which are being driven by people who have no care for everyday people. But it's also being driven by a machine that we strap ourselves to at our own risk. And so, of course, it's good for, we know from Twitter and how it works cognitively that they want you to be angry. They want you to be agitated. They want you to agree or disagree. There's no one on there that's playing a blue note. You know, and the blue note is where literature lives. The in-between states. Like, yes, there's a few fabulous, beautiful velvet weapons in literature. But there's also the best writing to me is understands states of not knowing. We're right down the hill from one of the best universities in the world. I was a judge for the National Book Award in nonfiction last year. I read you want to talk about 171? I read 550 Wow. books of nonfiction. I didn't read every word, but I read enough of them to know that some of them were not good, and some of them were good, and some of them were great. And the intellectual life of this country is thriving, you know? There was a brilliant biography by David Blight, who was here, of Frederick Douglass. The book that won our prize was a 29-year in the making biography of Elaine Locke by Jeffrey C. Stewart. He's not on Twitter. You know, and it's a biography full of contradictions of someone who is both...
Are you on Twitter?
Unfortunately. I think...
David Blight isn't on Twitter either.
But the book was full of contradictions about this character who was both backbiting and a bureaucrat, but full of a whole new idea of what transnational blackness meant. And I don't know, I think we really lose the plot if we start looking to all the things that say, like, that sound like good Twitter memes, you know? Because once you get into a room with other people, and as Anthony Appiah was pointing out, once you talk to people about who they live with, who they spend time with, like, maybe it's not working romantically between conservatives and liberals, but on a lot of other fronts, there's a great deal of complexity in human interaction. It's just not being reflected in the ways that we choose to get information.
Or anyone.
We can ask everybody here on the panel who's on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, I'm not. That's okay. Right?
I'm not. None of these. And as a matter of fact, my proud father here says his son is one of the leading experts on big data worldwide. He's not on Twitter either.
Mm-hmm. Anyone down the line there? Carlos.
I'm on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm not asking about Twitter, just in general.
My name is Carlos, and I'm on Twitter.
Yeah. He has to be on Twitter.
one thing that, first I want to have John write a piece for the Washington Post on everything he just said.
Yes.
What struck me, the words that struck me most when you were talking about the way that we consume information or are informed about what's significant in the culture is that it arrived more slowly. I think you said, and that's something that we're losing, and I think it's worth dwelling on. Fortunately, we're not losing it when institutions like the Paris Review are doing their work. So earlier I knocked all these resistance anthology books as kind of just preaching to the same choir. But one of them, a book I read called Radical Hope, had one essay, one. That I really, really liked. And it was by the novelist Keiji Kitamura. And she expressed concern about what she called the terrifying rapidity of views and voices that are coming right now, where that ability to kind of think through the culture is with and have it arrive slowly is not as present. And she wrote, we need to defend another way of thinking and being, one that allows for hesitation and mutability. I have a distrust of certitude, even when I agree with the essential position being advocated. I don't think the urgency of our situation means we cannot afford uncertainty. I need to believe in the value of the doubt I now feel, not least because it promotes thinking before acting. And I don't. That's where the quote ends. Now it's just me. That notion of doubt, of nuance, of slowness, is, I think, what is just so easily lost in the social media kind of environment. And when we look at Twitter and think that's dictating, it's not so much that it necessarily dictates what books get published or that kind of thing or the call out or cancel culture, but often in the world that I move in, you know, people with bigger Twitter followings, are able to promote their work more. They get booked by producers who are on Twitter. You know, it's easy. You know, I was talking to a friend who is part of a political television show, and he talked about the pressures they face to book guests that have big followings.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Why? Because it creates this multiplier effect, right? And yeah, perhaps even book festivals.
Even
right?
Book festivals, like, oh wow, that person has a big following.
Yeah, that person's going to promote our work. And when that becomes a gauge of not just influence but quality, that's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah.
I was
John. Anthony, and then John.
I can't get on the web, so I can't read you my last tweet. But it was of something like this. Since my childhood, one of my favorite remarks of Jesus's was, judge not, lest he be judged, for as he judged, so shall you be judged?
Right.
Paren, not a thought for the Twitter sphere.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
So I do that from time to time.
Yeah. John, you were going to call?
I'm on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Jane is seriously on Twitter.
It feels like a digital confessional.
Right.
I'm still secretly on Facebook.
You know. I know. Not as much as I used to be, because I'm like a lot of people I know who are deeply involved in thinking about our culture right now. I'm trying to find quiet time so I can digest what's been going on. But I do go onto Twitter to celebrate books and book culture. And I do that both under my own Twitter handle, but also on behalf of organizations that I volunteer my time for. And that over the years has included the National Book Critics Circle and the Writer's Grotto in San Francisco and other places where, and I like to retweet people who are celebrating the literary culture of our time. And
I want to disagree with you. I went on a positivity spree on Twitter. No likes. I was shoveling positivity into Twitter, and Twitter just said, no, thank you. And the second that I had some sort of edge, you know, to something that I tweeted, it was like, yes, thank you. Yum, 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 yum.
Oh, no.
And I mean, honestly, have you had that experience where you think if I...
Occasionally.
Yeah.
I think
Jesus would not be good on Twitter.
Person. Mm-hmm. I had to block one person.
Mm-hmm.
But something else that comes to mind, last year at this festival, there was a novelist named Winnie Lee who wrote a novel called Dark Chapter. She is a Taiwanese-American, born in New Jersey, studied at Harvard, went to London, was a film producer, went on a vacation to Belfast, was raped and beaten by a teenager. She changed her life, obviously. She dealt with the questions of the trauma and the violence. And then she turned around and wrote this novel from the point of view of both the rapist and his injured woman. And then she created an organization that would allow people to come together and talk about the issues of consent. And what struck me about that, it was making a bridge so that we were not in one place and then the other place and divided, but rather sort of like, as a journalist, I interviewed Archbishop Tutu at one point about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, in which people were looking at the question of how do we make good for justice. And also I interviewed the woman in charge of setting up the Gacaca process in Rwanda. And she said, Truth and Reconciliation didn't work for us, but we took a village approach that was a tradition in our country, and we had men and women as a village council and the whole village come in, and we had those who had been the perpetrators and those who had been the receivers of this amazing genocidal violence, and we sat them together and we had them converse about what had happened. And it occurs to me that if we had something similar, we could find a way to make a bridge so we wouldn't have the cancel culture that puts us in a narrow way. I'm reminded of the Gaddafi poem, Anthony, that was about walls that you included in your book. I can't quote it offhand. Maybe you can. But it was a wonderful approach to the idea of the walls keep us separated from each other. And I find that really troubling. And I would like us to make bridges if possible. I think there are some possibilities where you can't make bridges, but wouldn't it be nice if we could kind of reach across? And I think people are starting to do that. Some of the books I've been reviewing just recently for the BBC Culture column I write include a book called The Death and Life of Ada Hernandez. The author is here at the festival. Mm-hmm. And it gives a story from the point of view of a young woman raised on both sides of the border, back and forth, and the question of what it's like to be an immigrant on the corner of our Southwest in the United States and Mexico. And reading that book, which is a nonfiction book, gives an incredible amount of information about what's been happening. And a novel I just reviewed called by Julia Oringer called The Flight Portfolio talks about the work of Varian Fry, who went on behalf of the United States Rescue Committee in the late 30s to Marseille and helped Marcel I'm blanking. He helped surrealists like...
You think Alfred Barr?
Huh?
Right.
Alfred Barr?
No. Yeah, Alfred Barr is the one who set up the committee. But Varian Fry was the one who went to Marseille. He created ways out of Vichy France so that surrealist artists and intellectuals would not be deported by the Gestapo to concentration camps. So it's something that if you read it today and you read it now, it's a little frightening to realize the incremental drumbeat of what was coming, because we sit and watch a change in our democracy and in the laws and in the inclusiveness this country has had for many years. Those are just a couple of the books that I've been reading that I think are kind of a new way of thinking about what could we publish right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, quickly, Michael, and actually, you know what, can I read that quote? That Kafadi? Yeah, okay, it's a wonderful, Kavafi, that's right, Kavafi writes, it's a poem, and it's called Walls. Without reflection, without sorrow, without shame, they've built around me great high walls, and I sit here now and despair. I think of nothing else. This fate consumes my mind because I had so many things to do out there. And Anthony quotes that in The Lies That Bind.
It's a great poem.
Yeah. Do you want to comment on that? Or
could you just read my comment?
Yes. His comment is, absolutely.
Just a little bit longer.
Yeah, his comment is, we all have many things to, quote, do out there in the world, and the problem is not walls as such, but walls that hedge us in. Walls we play no part in designing, walls without doors and windows, walls that block our vision and obstruct our way, walls that will not let in fresh and enlivening air. Good stuff. Yeah. You know, one of the things that Anthony mentions in this book is he talks about how really the history of civilization is one of cultural appropriation, which is such a, you know, contentious topic right now. But he makes a distinction that really what is offensive is disrespect and exploitation, not the fact of borrowing elements of culture, because that's actually how civilization has been developed. Can you comment on that? And then we'll go to Michael.
Right. I think in many of the moments when people complain about cultural appropriation that I agree with, I agree that something has gone wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't agree that what's gone wrong is cultural appropriation, mm-hmm. because I think that that's how all the things that I most care about were made. Even in some of the places that we don't remember this. So one of my favorite examples of this is that Kazuo Basho, who's a 17th century Japanese poet and haiku master, he's a Buddhist. And he's writing in a script that was invented in China. And the Buddha was not Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Indian.
So without China and India... One of the greatest of the Japanese poets disappears if you don't allow, and just try, you know, how much of Shakespeare would survive if you weren't allowed to take from other places or other times, or
right.
If you weren't allowed as a man to imagine the voice of a woman, or as a, depending on whether you think he was gay or straight. A straight person to imagine, a gay person to imagine the life of a straight, and so on.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, but people steal. Stealing is wrong. I think copyright laws are useful and important, and there wouldn't be so much publishing without them. But that's a different question and in fact, in our copyright law, rightly, there's a certain kind of derivativeness, namely mocking, mm-hmm. which is protected. You're allowed to mock someone by copying their style because parody is protected, rightly, under our copyright understanding. So I think when people create things together with other people or with material from other people, that when there's something wrong in the relationship between the people doing it, then that's obviously a problem. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's ever the problem that somebody took something that was in some sense not theirs in the sense of their identity. I think that's how, I just can't imagine how boring all the cultures of the world would be if they had that attitude. Mm-hmm. And they don't. Mm-hmm. My mother and I collected 7,500 proverbs in my father's language in Ghana, and the word lorry occurs in a lot of them. That's the way we say lorry or truck. Hmm. Does that mean it's not a tree proverb because it's about a truck? And because the word we use for truck is derived from English, is the fact that our word for bread is panu, which presumably comes from the Portuguese, is that a reason for us to reject bread or to give it some new name? I mean, this is the sort of thing that went in the kind of purification of the German language that went on in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, getting rid of the Romance words and so on. I think it's very, very bad for the sorts of things that we should care about in the domain of culture.
But the disrespect of certain cultures and groups, and to go back to Twitter, I mean, there's finally an opportunity for some of these groups to speak. And so that's what's going on.
Right. You shouldn't, you know, if you understand what the Kaddish is, you should not, there are lots of contexts in which it would be quite inappropriate to use it, whether you're Jewish or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Michael, you've been trying to say something. Do you want to jump back in?
All my life I've been trying to say something. And actually, I want to go back to basically contradict myself, which I also love to, and that is the fact that I mentioned in the beginning, it's so hard to discern how books actually do make a political or societal difference. It is very hard. As I said, sociologists spend a lot of money and time of their life on finding out how exactly did this or that book or that political intellectual movement come about. Can you logically derive from A, from B, to C, to, let's say, mass murder? How did it happen? It's an issue in Germany, as you can imagine, for 50 years of historiography. But I'd like to give a notion of something positive, where actually books made an enormous difference, but still pretty much unforeseen. I had the world right, so to speak, my publishing house, of Václav Havel's books. Mm-hmm. And it's an absolutely miracle that a couple of books, one in particular, written out of jail, Letters to Olga, made him the president of a pretty fascinating, fairly new country, the state of Czechoslovakia, which dissolved. However, it was done by books. And as it so happened, the company that I later ran, Henry Holt, had the American rights. And he's not a superb writer. He's not a superb playwright. What he really is and was a genuine man of truly anti-totalitarian and, by the way, truly bourgeois taste. And he was able to convey to other folks through written words that the state the country was living in under a truly suppressed system of the Czech communist system was, so to speak, the last one to crumble next to Germany. But he was able to show that actually to think freely about life and freedom is fun. And I'd like to point out one day he was arrested in the bed of his best friend's wife, Pavel Kohut. And the Czechs thought that's funny. And in a way, Kohut, the only one who thought it was not funny was Kohut. But the rest of the nation laughed at this on the bridge of being a clown, intellectual of great inner backbones and quality. So that writer and his friends, Jiří Gruža, nobody remembers him, but these people changed the world of their nation through books, through written words. I don't know any other writer at the moment in the last 20 centuries, in the 20th century, who had such a huge success, and I'm talking about books sold, not so many. But the quality of his existence as a writer was so pure and so enjoyable that a whole nation followed him. Mm. So that, I think, is one of the greatest examples of how books actually do change the world to the positive. And they did, and unfortunately, he's long dead, he's forgotten, he doesn't sell anymore, neither here nor in Prague. But the nation that he created exists, and the constitution that he founded exists.
Yeah.
So there's an example for the Nobel Prize Committee, which of course missed him too.
We're going to take some questions. So there is a microphone, the man over to your left, and feel free to go over there. And let's just jump right in, because there's a lot of questions.
Oh, okay.
Okay, ma'am, yes.
Hi. I wanted to know what the panelists thought about the firestorm at the New York Review of Books last year. And specifically, is that something that happens because of the Twitter culture, no nuance world that we live in today? Or is it because of the interwebs and the power of everyone speaking that has specifically given women a voice in our culture that hasn't been there for until now?
Mm-hmm. Anyone want to comment? Carlos? No?
I'm trying to remember. It was, I think that if, it was an Isaac Chotiner interview, right, by the editor that really sort of sealed the fate of that story. And I think if what was interesting there was not just the article that was published in the New York Review, but the manner in, where did the person, okay, hi, sorry. But then the, in the eyes of many, the manner in which the editor sort of explained the decision to publish. And I think, I thought of that when, Emily, when you mentioned that, you know, we haven't made a decision at the Paris Review to not publish something because we were afraid it would offend. But presumably you go through a thought process to decide to publish something, right? In every case, with every piece, with every story. Mm-hmm. And here it was, I think, not a combination of not just the article in question, but of the description by the editor of the not tremendously rigorous process that they went through to make the decision to publish. And I think that...
I don't think there was a they there is the problem.
Yes, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it was one person.
Yes, it's a lot. They sounds like too many people. And I would imagine, I could imagine a universe where, you know, the editing structure at the New York Review had not changed. If the subsequent explanation for the publication of the piece had been more thoughtful and nuanced. You don't have to go all the way like the way The Nation magazine went and kind of groveling after publishing its poem. But there's an in-between. Between sort of like utter thoughtlessness and I don't care what this person really did or didn't do in his or her life.
Right.
And the other extreme of sort of like abnegation.
Yeah.
Sorry, does everyone know the...
Yeah, I was just going to ask
tell
you...
the story
yeah,
with
yeah.
all the... I don't know all the details
okay.
of it. I don't know if someone
do you
can
know
explain
the
it better.
I don't know all the details. I'll just say, like, in terms of the compounding effect of Twitter, it was on Yom Kippur, and I had turned off my phone for the day. And I came back. I was in Seattle visiting a sick family member. And so just the idea of stepping outside of sort of the real time or hyper time of literary Twitter for 24 hours to do something that felt very much more important than that, and then to turn back on my phone and the editorship of the New York Review was gone.
It was over. Right.
Was over.
Yeah.
And that was staggering.
Yeah. I don't know the names. I should. But there was Ian Buruma allowed the publishing of an article which told the story. Maybe someone knows the specific names. Told the story of a man who had been accused of sexual harassment. And there was a perception that it was sort of allowing the perpetrator to speak. And many said, well, you should allow him to speak, but some people thought it was very inappropriate the way that it was presented. John, do you want to elaborate on that, or is that about right?
Yeah, it was a poorly written article, not very well defended, casually published into an environment of explosive feelings about what the role was of men who had been abusers or been accused of abusing, what they should be doing when they had lost their platforms. And this article basically was describing what it was like to suddenly be invisible. And I think there was an understandable reaction as to, well, why do we even need to know this? Isn't it much more important to know what it's like to maybe be on the other side of your abuse? And I don't have a strong, I'm not going to defend or not defend Ian Buruma, but shortly after that, David Remnick had invited Steve Bannon to be a presenter at the New Yorker Festival, and he very almost lost his job. He responded very quickly. He wrote an article not defending his decision, but apologizing, but then explaining why he had made the decision to invite Bannon to the festival. And, I think you can be completely on the side for justice and decency and also say that the speed of the reaction to some of those things. David Remnick reported in post-Glasnost Russia. He's an extraordinary journalist. The New Yorker has made some mistakes. I was not smoking gun. Mushroom Cloud is a smoking gun. I thought he made a huge mistake writing that op-ed during the Iraq war buildup. But the New Yorker has done extraordinary reporting, and to sort of wipe him away mm-hmm. for what was a very bad decision, which he very quickly corrected, I think would have been an enormous loss for journalism.
The subtext of both cases is a very simple one. Freedom of the press implies and possibly even means freedom of the owners of the press to decide how they like and wish to. And that is something, I call it the dirty secret of my professional journalism and publishing. There's always somebody actually who also has a taste. Mm-hmm. And his taste may be very badly reasoned and full of prejudices, mm-hmm. but we'll never hear about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a war, who are the gatekeepers
Absolutely.
Right now that's been going on.
And usually it's the owners.
Yeah, who are the gatekeepers, right. But there's a protest against that right now. There's a push for how we define and who we listen to in terms of what gets published and what the public discourse is.
And on a weekend like this, and on a panel in a room like this, we focus on books. We have been focusing on books. But mm-hmm. I think this question, this example shows that books are just one battleground
yeah.
in these broader culture wars. It can be the editorship of the New York Review. It can be hosting a television show. It can be any number of these arenas where these battles take place.
Yeah, yeah. We should go to the next question.
Systemic blindness. Could you raise your hand? The Matrix. Could you raise your hand if you know that Annie Oakley in 1910 sued the media 55 times and she won 54 times?
Okay.
The documentary Hot Coffee, themovie.com, we've been brainwashed not to sue. Nobody knows it. Okay, so the question is, did you know about systemic blindness that might cause discomfort to all of you and all of them? The state of California county by county court system provides free mediation with an 80% success rate.
Okay. Anyone want to comment on that? Systemic blindness? I mean, I know that, and I'm not sure if this gets to, if this relates to the question, but there is currently a controversy in the publishing world about what's called morality clauses that go into a writer's contract, that if the writer strays past certain boundaries, so to speak, or there's a public outcry over how the author is seen to have trespassed against certain, I don't even know if it's morality, but to where the book is pulled or the book is killed, and the publisher has invested quite a bit in it, that the, am I getting it right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, John says yes. Yeah, you know better than I do. Yeah.
I'm just going to guess. Yeah. But in response to what you're saying, our culture does need forms of mediation between each other, and if what you're saying is that California courts allow free mediation with high success rates between individuals and parties in dispute, there needs to be places where that kind of thing can happen. And I'm not going to return too hard on the internet, but we did have much more local culture before we started using the internet. You know, we didn't shop online. We went to, you know, the businesses we went to were local. You know, we went to local churches. You know, we didn't stay at home and sit in front of our gadgets. And I think we need these clearinghouses to basically disagree with each other in person. You know, you have mediation, I don't think, in my opinion or in my experience, doesn't work well when it's not done face to face. And if we do everything, including reading, which was a very private and intimate and emotional experience, at this remove from each other, I think that only leads to further disagreements, which may not exist if we were actually in the same room.
Yeah. Just Thank you. We should go to the next question. We have quite a few.
We've heard a lot about, first of all, thank you all for speaking to us today. This has been very enlightening. We've heard a lot about the cancel culture. We've heard a lot about how fast you have to come to market with your review of books and how that drives sales. Specifically to Carlos Lozada, do you think that this deadline, you know, that's hours away, that we're not getting an entire review, that we're getting an impulse, do you think you would have written a different review if it was days away? Do you think that that's changing our expert opinions of books, that we have to make a decision about this book because we have to get it out there because the deadline was the minute that it was published?
Yes. Yes, I'm gonna take a moment to think about what you asked me. I often wish I could, go back and reread books that I've reviewed already, and see if I feel the same way about them. You know, because a book comes out, you know, and it comes out at a certain moment in time, at a certain moment in the culture, at a certain moment in my own life, you know, and I may feel about it one way, and, you know, it can be a month, it can be a year, it can be two, and I can, look back. I have a bookshelf in my house that is just for the books that I've reviewed, and I look at some of those, and I have, you know, I look at the spine, and I have deep feelings about this one book, and I know exactly where I was when I was reading it, and how I felt, and certain quotes. And I look at other books, and I have no memory of ever having opened them, even though I wrote a review about them. You know, hopefully it was interesting. And so yes, I do wish that I had that kind of time, and it's often the most sort of newsy books where you have the least time to spend with them. It's ridiculous that I would, you know, stay up all night to write about the Mueller report, you know, and then that my review would be posted about 27 hours after the book was online, after the report was online. And that doesn't make any sense, right? And often what happens is with the most, this is like way too in the weeds of my daily frustrations, but the books that are a big deal are embargoed. Publishers don't release early copies to reviewers, and so they all come out at the same time, and all the critics are rushing to review them at once. Places like the Paris Review, like the New York Review of Books, like others, have the luxury of waiting sometimes. The New York Review just doesn't care. They publish like their review of Hillary Clinton's, you know, what happened like a year afterwards, you know? And it's great, it's authoritative, it's thoughtful, incorporates everything that's happened since. You know, do you remember the book existed at that point? I don't know, you know? But I read it. So yes, I do think that the imperatives of deadlines and of the industry, at a place like the Washington Post where, you know, we publish something every day and actually publish something every moment, makes it harder. I try to break free of that a little bit. I try to not be hostage to the schedules of the publishing world, and I kind of try to organize my time around what ideas do I think are important to grapple with, and then, okay, I want to find a kind of book way into that. When I reviewed Anthony's book, I read it along with like seven other books on identity that had come out over the course of a year. And so I read them all and spent some time with all of them and tried to come up with something that would be useful. Whether it was fair to each and every book, I don't know, and frankly, I don't care, you know, because my responsibility isn't to the authors or the publishers, but it's the readers of the Post. That's one way to kind of break free of that, but there are moments when you can't, and it's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
Can I just
say,
just on that point, I mean, you mentioned that the review, the New York Review, has a different time scale. Mm-hmm. Bob Silvers once gave me some things to review, and I said, but it's going to take me, it may take me, you know, months and months to get back to you because I've got all this stuff. Yeah. And he said, you know us. So the more important point is that there are people operating on different timescales. So mm-hmm. I think there's a place, yeah. Certainly with something like the Mueller report. I think it was important that it was read in that way at the same time as it was being read by the... Mm-hmm. The other kinds of readers, right. But then people will reflect upon it, and there'll be other discussions of it. Then there'll be classes in which it's discussed, yeah. And then there will be a political science literature and a history literature that review it carefully against the background of other things. That's okay. I don't think there's anything bad about having an immediate take, as long as you know that the culture is going to have these other takes as well.
Well, let's hope it does, because I mean, books are hardly in the bookstore 6 months after.
And that gets to Michael's point as well about the influence that books have. Sometimes the influence isn't going to be immediate. There are books that have had lasting influence that, and not just books, any kind of cultural product, for lack of a better word, that have had lasting influence that came later, came over time. People would realize. That something in subtle ways changed the way we thought about an event or about an idea or a movement or a moment. And so it seems now like there are, you know, if it doesn't, you know, hit the bestseller list right away, if it doesn't resonate with whatever metrics you want to use, that it kind of disappears and goes away. But sometimes books can linger in our minds and end up affecting a lot more than we imagine beyond the immediate book review.
Yeah.
Which is why those Twitter clicks really shouldn't be the simple judge of what people's attention is. Because the Twitter clicks and the Facebook clicks and all of that, the clicks that are so important to the news organizations today do not reflect the conversations we all have. And there's no way in which they are the sum total of the attention that books are getting, and book reviews are getting.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more question, about 2 minutes.
I have a philosophy question for Anthony. It seems to me that, you know, as an outsider, which you are, and you've been an outsider for most of your life, it forces a kind of moderation that is impossible to impose on the majority. So the reason for that is simply by definition of being outside the box, you have a better view of all the players, which the majority can never have simply by virtue of being insiders. So by definition, there will always be one Anthony Appiah, there will always be one Sotomayor, and 9 other people, or 5 other people. And I'm speaking of Trump versus Hawaii. And so if this is the case, the majority, as you talked about, will always lapse into tribal bias. They will always separate into tribes. If this is true, what do you think about the argument that the Singaporean model and the German models, which ban free speech, like swastikas and so on, in favor of social harmony, are a better model than the more freewheeling, laissez-faire American model? And I say this with full knowledge that Singapore, you know, has jailed Jehovah's Witnesses, but the fact remains that they have still, that America, with its more open model, has far more people in jail who are minorities.
I think the question of how a society implements what is now the universal obligation under the Declaration of Human Rights and the Covenants to embody a regime of free expression, where everybody's supposed to be doing that, has to take account of the history of each country and the kind of legal system it has, and the habits and practices of its people. We are very used to all sorts of limitations on expression in this country, even though we're proud of our First Amendment protections. So lots and lots of useful information about what's going on at Google is not available to anybody, because anybody who leaves Google signs a non-disclosure agreement. That's a limitation on free expression. It's one we permit. And maybe there's a good reason for permitting it. But in other places, those can be overruled by considerations of the public interest in a way that it's rather hard to do here. So, I'm generally speaking in favor of the freedom of expression regime we have in the United States, but it's not unlimited, and it has some limits that other people don't have. Do I think it's okay that in Denmark you can be fined for insulting a racial or a religious group? Since they almost never do it, and since people insult racial and religious groups in Denmark all the time, I'm probably not too worried about that as a serious limitation on anybody's expressing anything. Do I think it's a tragedy that you can't publish Mein Kampf? No, not in Germany. Not really. So I think Britain is very proud of its free expression stuff, but its libel laws are preposterous. They put a huge burden on all kinds of publishers who are trying just to publish the truth about things, and allow powerful people, rich people, to make it less likely that the truth about them will be published. So I think there are lots of ways in which the reality of the regime of free expression in a particular place is usually more complicated than our kind of picture of it. So it's against the background of thinking like that that I would then go on at vast length to explore with you exactly which features of our system we might want to reform and what forms of reform we might want to encourage in other places. On the question of, I do think it's a privilege to have a place as an outsider, but there's also insider's privileges as well. There are things that someone who's always, as it were, been fully embedded in one place, which I have never been, can see. And so I want to hear from them. I want to hear from the fully embedded people who don't see things as I have to, because I, you know, grew up between two places and had parents from two continents and so on. If there were one philosophical idea that I would hope that we could teach all the people who come through our schools and colleges, it's that knowledge is hard. It's not easy to get things right, and that you're more likely to get it right if you listen to people who've come at the world from many different directions. If you just look at the world from one place, even if it's or five places or whatever it is, you don't get the best picture. And that's one of the reasons why the sort of cordoning of people off into little epistemic worlds of their own deprives all of them of the possibility of learning from each other. And books, the story of books changing the world is maybe a hard story to tell, but the story of books changing particular lives, that's an easy story to tell. And they come, and you know, my life in Ghana was changed by reading James Baldwin, right? Not a Ghanaian, never been to Ghana, not interested in Ghana, probably. And actually, for me, the most useful James Baldwin book was one that nobody reads anymore, which is Giovanni's Room, because I was coming out to myself as gay, and it's one of the few great mid-20th century American gay novels. So that changed my life. And I think people's lives are being changed all the time, not usually by being switched from, you know, the liberal side of things to the conservative side of things on the basis of one book. But I think, in a way, someone who's going to change that way is probably a little bit unstable, a little bit too easy to move. It should take time to get from one place to another on the political spectrum. People who do it like that, you know, they'll be back on the other side 20 minutes later. So I think it should take time.
Thank you. Thank you to all of you. You will have an opportunity to hear both Anthony and Carlos right in half an hour from now. They'll be speaking at the Freight and Salvage. Carlos will be interviewing Anthony on The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. And Emily has a panel later on the Paris Review. Its recent issue features Lawrence Ferlinghetti in an Art of Poetry interview, and we're going to have a tribute to him, and Emily is going to be moderating that. And Michael will be around the, we have a German pavilion called Wunderbar Together in the Outdoor Fair, and there's a lot of German literature and German culture that is talked about there. And I think that's it. Jane, you going to be around?
Can we just say hello, congratulations, Sherilyn, for the fifth year of the Bay Area Book Club?
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.